This is an ABC podcast.
Back in 2009, Christian Van Vuren was in his 20s. He was earning a lot of money working in outdoor advertising, and he planned a big overseas trip. He spent 6 weeks partying in South America, but then he became ill. He became feverish, and he had a cough that he just couldn't shake. Back in Australia, he was at a business lunch in a swanky restaurant when he began to cough up blood. Doctors diagnosed him with a dangerous and rare form of a disease that couldn't be treated with antibiotics. And so in 2010, he was placed in quarantine inside a 3-metre by 4-metre hospital room at Sydney Hospital, overlooking Martin Place. While doctors tried to find a cocktail of drugs that could drive the bug from all the nooks and crannies in his system. While trapped in that room, Christian went through a cycle of emotions from self-pity to fear to gratitude. And then for fun, he began to make these funny hip-hop videos of himself in isolation. And he posted them on a new service called YouTube. And they became famous all over the world. And Channel 9 dubbed him the fully sick rapper. Then in 2010, after months of isolation, Christian was released back into the world, where everything looked, smelt, felt, and tasted great. And he had a completely different sense of who he was and what he wanted to do with his life. I spoke with Christian just over a year ago when we'd all gone into lockdown over COVID, and the whole thing was a bit eerily reminiscent of the last time he was put into captivity by a disease. Tell me about your life, what it was like before you got sick, Christian.
I guess I was just like any other 27-year-old dude. I lived a very active lifestyle. I kind of lived for working hard, partying hard, socializing a lot, you know, using my weekends for drinking with friends. By weekends, they probably stretched from Thursday through Sunday. I was single at the time, had recently come out of a pretty long-term relationship, so my main focuses in life were kind of like meeting girls and having a good time with my friends and doing what I could to succeed from a career level.
What was your job at the time?
At the time, I was working for JC Deco, which are an outdoor advertising, you know, they own billboards, bus shelters, train stations, all outdoor advertising stuff. So I started working for them initially in direct sales, where my job would be kind of calling up random businesses and kind of small clients and asking them if they wanted to advertise on local sites. And that then evolved into me running a kind of portfolio of media agencies who I dealt with. That would involve getting briefs on like, oh, you know, Coke have a campaign, they want to reach an audience of this age, this demographic, and then we plot out a outdoor advertising billboard campaign and execute it.
Was that lucrative? I mean, were you making good money doing that?
It was really lucrative because in particular, it was a very expensive outdoor sales proposition. So you're often talking about advertising packages that are in excess of $500,000 up to a mil and a half for a 3-month campaign with on and off bursts. So the bonuses and the stuff on top of the salary itself was very lucrative. I was living in a beautiful apartment, driving a nice car, had all those kind of like the little extras of a corporate job, you know, we had parking in the city and a car allowance and bonuses and a nice salary. And, you know, it was pretty comfy.
So you were 27 years old and that's when you decided to go on this big adventure to South America. How much fun were you having when you got there, Christian?
Probably too much fun, medically speaking. I mean, you know, it was me and one of my best mates and we were just traveling. We went to Argentina, Brazil, and we were traveling from backpackers to backpackers, drinking a lot, doing as much partying as we could. It was one of those holidays. It was like a let's blow off some steam and have a 6-week bender kind of holiday. But at some point during that trip, I started to develop a pretty severe cough. And I'd assumed, you know, that I was just kind of running my immune system into the ground as a result of drinking every day and, you know, burning through cigarettes and generally not paying heaps of attention to my own nutrition and well-being.
Were you feeling feverish as well?
Yeah, the day it hit, we were in a backpackers in Rio, and I had this 24 hours of just going from like severe hot to freezing cold, severe hot, freezing cold, like fully drenched in sweat to then just like shivering and then drenched in sweat and then shivering. And it was in a shared dorm of like 8 people. So people kept coming in and out of this dorm and in this backpackers. It was a hellish day. But after that day, I tried to take myself to the doctors and I went down, I tried to book an appointment, but they were just too busy and they couldn't see me. And then I went to a medical center and had the same situation. They were too busy, couldn't see me. And so I walked into a pharmacy and I just bought a load of like, you know, the closest thing to Panadol that I could find, you know, paracetamol and some cough medicine. I honestly was just assuming that I'd picked up some little kind of local chest infection or something. The day all those fevers happened, we went to the beach and I was swimming in the water at Rio and I got dumped by a wave and I ended up kind of copping a lung full of water. And I thought, oh, I've just got some bug, you know, I've got some bug from swimming. But I had no idea how severe this would all end.
So what happened when you got back to Australia?
Yeah, so I got home to Australia. The fevers had kind of stopped all apart from some regular night sweats, and I guess I convinced myself that this was my body getting rid of whatever toxins. I mean, this is so not a medical thing, but I just convinced myself it was just my body kind of detoxing itself after, you know, 6 weeks of treating my liver like rubbish. I had these kind of regular night sweats and I was losing a bit of weight, and I still had this cough, but it wasn't as dominant as it was when I was overseas. It was just kind of a bit annoying. But I went back to work and I'd just done a deal for Tourism Australia, who'd booked a massive campaign around the country, and I took them all to lunch to celebrate. We went to this kind of fancy restaurant in the Rocks and had the clients from the media buying agency there and some of the clients from Tourism Australia there. Real fancy restaurant, expeno, nice steaks, beers on the table, champagne for everyone. And then I start coughing and I just can't stop coughing. So I kind of step away from the table and I cover my mouth and I'm coughing. And it will not stop. And then something happens and my coughing starts getting worse. And I reckon I probably coughed for about a minute before I realized that my hand felt moist. And I looked down at my hand and it was covered in blood. And time stood still for a moment because you don't see that. You know, like if you're coughing blood, you're either, I don't know, you're turning into a zombie, you're being shot in the chest by an arrow, or you're Nicole Kidman in Moulin Rouge. Like, I knew that wasn't good. And I ran to the bathroom, couldn't stop coughing and kind of coughing blood into this sink. And then the blood was followed by, I can only assume it was some sort of tissue from my chest. I tried to call an ambulance, but I couldn't talk to the ambulance. So I ran back into the restaurant and I ran back in with like blood all over my chin, dripping down my shirt, just waving my phone around going, ambulance, ambulance, still coughing, and handed the phone to a client. They spoke to the ambulance and said, please send an ambulance, blah, blah, blah. And meanwhile, everyone else in this fancy restaurant has just stopped eating because I think they all think that I've swallowed glass or something, or that I've, you know, had some glass in my meal and it's killing me. It was a pretty dramatic scene.
There was part of you that was sort of conscious about the kind of weird spectacle that you were presenting to this restaurant, you know, covered in blood and coughing all the time.
Totally. And I felt really kind of sorry for everyone as a result of it. I was a little bit out of my body for a lot of this experience, almost kind of looking down on myself running between this restaurant and the bathroom and out the front leaning on a wall. And, you know, waiters are bringing me serviette after serviette after serviette because I kept getting covered in blood. Yeah, I was a bit kind of outside of myself for this whole thing. I could really feel what it must look like to somebody else who's watching this.
What happened when you got to the hospital, Christian?
Well, as soon as the ambos actually got there, they threw a mask on me and they started asking, where have you been? What's your travel history? You know, all those sorts of questions. And they had masks on when they approached me. So, you know, I knew immediately that they were thinking this is some kind of disease. So they take me to the nearest hospital, which is Sydney Hospital. They rush me in, immediately get some bloods taken. All the vitals are checked. They give me a chest x-ray. And somebody came in and did the kind of apology. You know, really sorry to tell you this, but you have a hole in your lung. I asked how big it was. They said it's about the size of a 50-cent piece. And they don't know what it is. And so I immediately, I was on the like, oh, I've got lung cancer. That's what this is. I've got lung cancer. My years of casual smoking have now given me lung cancer and I'm going to pay my dues and this is how I die. But then they said pretty quickly, look, it's more likely going to be some form of aggressive pneumonia or perhaps TB, but it would be, you know, very rare for someone of your age to and immune system to get TB. And anyway, they took some samples of my sputum, and the next day they said, look, we can confirm you have tuberculosis, and the treatment of that is going to be 21 days spent quarantined in hospital, followed by 6 months of ongoing antibiotic treatment. We're going to get you started on the drugs immediately.
Christian, was there part of you thinking, tuberculosis? Like, that's consumption. This is all a bit 19th century.
100%. Like, you don't hear it spoken about. Like, it seems like a non-existent disease. It's as weird as somebody telling you you've got the Black Plague. I was totally like, I'm not a 17th century prostitute. Like, how do I have tuberculosis? Yeah.
So what was the doctor's theory about how you'd contracted it?
Well, the theories kind of moved around a little bit just during the treatment itself. So during that first 3 weeks, everybody assumed things were going well. I mean, it appeared to be that in my tests that I was giving, that the amount of bugs that they were finding in the samples were dropping. So that was making people assume that the medications were all working fine. And it was initially thought that because I'd just returned from South America, that I'd picked up this tuberculosis in South America. And that was the simple, reasonable response to that. And because the initial diagnosis was 21 days isolated, you know, followed by 6 months treatment, I'd been entirely focused on this finish line of 3 weeks' time. Like, I can handle this. It's 3 weeks. Put my head down. Have some fun in here. Do what I can. Learn some new things. Watch some TV shows. Read some books. Then I'll get out of here. I'll go back to my job. Do my treatment. So I built my entire well-being and kind of sanity around this deadline of 3 weeks away. And so I got through the first 3 weeks and managed to maintain a certain sense of, I guess, pride and felt okay about myself and hadn't, you know, been destroyed by the process. And 3 weeks came around, I went home, but I just did not feel any better. Like, I physically felt terrible.
And what were you looking like at that point?
By this point, I'd dropped about 16 kilograms off my body weight. And I wasn't a heavy guy to begin with. So, I mean, I later found out my friends were calling me the machinist behind my back, which is a particular role that Christian Bale dropped a huge amount of weight for, to look like a prisoner of war. So I dropped a huge amount of body weight. I was still coughing, and I lived on a fourth floor apartment building that had no elevator. So I had to walk up the stairs, and every time I'd walk up those stairs to my apartment, I would cough blood. And every second or third morning I'd wake up, I'd sit up and I would cough blood. And so I actually took myself back to hospital twice, once by driving myself there in a bit of a panic, and another time by actually calling an ambulance because I thought I was dying. And on both of those occasions, my vitals returned to normal when I got through emergency, and the doctors assumed that, you know, this is just a natural part of the healing. You had a hole in your lung. It's still that. Despite the fact that we've tackled the infection, that hole is still healing. So there will be kind of continuous blood until that's managed to close itself up. So I finally developed the confidence to be able to start back work again. I guess I was probably out for about a week and a half, and I went to my first day at work. And it was on that first day at work that I got a phone call from the hospital saying, look, we're so sorry. We've just got some test results back from the lab. It turns out that your TB is multi-drug resistant. Now, that was a pretty intense phone call for me to receive, because weeks earlier, when I'd first been diagnosed, I jumped on Dr. Google and was searching about tuberculosis and reading about TB, because like we said, hadn't heard about it for years, didn't even know it still existed. And I was researching TB when I stumbled across this multi-drug resistant TB, this MDR TB. And the mortality rates were horrifying. The effect it had on people was horrifying. And I said to the doctor, what's the chances that I have this MDR TB? And the doctor said, mate, honestly, don't even go there. Don't think about it. It's not a thing here. There's no way you'll have that. And I said, but what's the odds? Like, what's the, you know, if I'm a gambling man, what, where am I putting my money? And he's like, mate, not like less than 1%. Don't even think about it. And so to receive that phone call saying you have multi-drug resistant TB, I was in the less than 1%. That immediately took my case level from being something that they deal with in terms of hundreds of cases a year of TB to something that they deal with on one hand in Australia, the number of cases of MDR-TB. And so I drove back home, chucked everything I could in my car that I could bring into hospital, and I came back into hospital for what was going to be I don't know how long period of time, because essentially I was going to be quarantined until they could crack a combination of drugs that would kill the tuberculosis.
So Christian, how on earth did you contract such an incredibly rare strain of TB?
Yeah, I suppose when they checked the resistance pattern of the organisms, they actually decided this doesn't look like it's come from South America. We don't see this kind of multi-drug resistance developed in those areas. However, we do see that in South Africa and in lots of areas of Africa. And it turns out that I had lived in South Africa for a year and a half in 2005. And so the doctors now assumed, you didn't just get this in South America, you got this 5 years ago in South Africa, and it has laid dormant, and you've just destroyed your immune system in South America, and so it's come out then.
So that bug was dormant in your system, what, for 4 years?
Yes.
And it was just waiting for an opportunity to burst through your immune system.
Yeah, and the doctors told me that people can have latent tuberculosis for 20, 30, 40 years. Like, people can have it in their lungs for their entire lifetime, and then they have a heart attack when they're 65 and it comes out because their immune system is destroyed by that event. The thing about TB is that it's tiny, tiny, tiny. Like, it is one of the smallest little microbacterium, and the reason they have to treat it with five different antibiotics is because it's so small and it replicates so quickly that it has all these advantages over our immune systems. It can bury itself very deep in the lung tissue where the natural antibodies produced by your immune system can't actually physically get to it. They can't reach it down these tiny little caves that it's created in your lungs. And so on one level, that allows it to sit latent or dormant for many, many years in some people. And on another level, when you actually are treating it, it's able to move, shake off the antibiotics, it's able to evolve really quickly, and it's able to, in some cases, if the antibiotic treatment isn't followed through to the full extent, it's able to develop resistance. And so, yeah, this version that I had of it was, of the five antibiotics they were giving me to treat tuberculosis, it was completely resistant to four of them, and one of them had only a kind of minor effect on it. So at the point that the doctors realized that I had multi-drug resistant tuberculosis, they had to come up with an entirely new series of antibiotics to treat it.
Given that you had a vanishingly rare disease and then an incredibly rare form of a vanishingly rare disease, was there a bit of magical thinking going on there? Christian, was there a bit of, why has this happened to me? Am I a bad person? Did you start entertaining sort of strange thoughts like that?
I reckon across the first couple of months of me going back into hospital, I was having thoughts of, this is the universe's retribution on me for all the shitty choices I've made in life. This is anything bad I've ever done to anyone coming back at me tenfold. It would shift between that and then also those kind of like, why me? What have I done? Ah, like punching walls and stomping around the room and I don't deserve this, and you know, states of mega depression where I'd be going like, I do deserve this. This is exactly what I deserve.
So that means you had to be sealed off from the rest of the world and go into this sealed off hospital room. What was it like?
It was a 3x4 meter hospital room. It was, you know, just a small sterile place with a little green single seat sofa lounge, one of those mechanical beds, a bunch of mysterious medical gear and plugs and PowerPoints and a drip, a tiny little cupboard to keep my hospital gowns in, and a window that overlooked Martin Place. And that was a kind of surreal thing for me because I worked in the CBD. I was constantly walking around the CBD from meeting to meeting, and now I was kind of confined in this tiny room at the very head of Martin Place, like up the hill. And all I looked out on every day was just the swarm of people coming and going from the city every morning, like ants in suits coming in from 8 till 9 a.m. and then almost a ghost town all day. And then that 5 p.m., 6 p.m. rush of everyone leaving, getting back on buses and dispersing, and then just a silent, empty city all night.
And what were you thinking when you looked down on those swarms of suits sort of zooming in and zooming out and dashing here and dashing there? What were you thinking as you were looking at them going about their day-to-day untuberculosis-affected lives?
Personally, I started to realise that a lot of these people looked sad, that there just seemed something sad about that, about so many people kind of just pouring in the morning, spending their days there and then pouring home again. Now, I may well have been imposing my own sadness on other people, because for a long time, though I loved the company I worked for and I loved my job as a job, I just had wondered whether it was for me. Like, is this the thing I want to be doing with my life? And that wasn't selling outdoor advertising in particular, but it was, you know, working in the city and having to write whip reports every week and having to sell stuff. And I'd wondered whether that office city thing was for me. What I was understanding in this time, when you have like an experience that makes you contemplate your life and what you've done with it and how you've used your time, if you think you're going to die, you're certainly not thinking about what have I achieved on a career level? How much did I over-deliver on those targets? What clients have I got on the go? You're not having any of those thoughts. All you're thinking about is like, shit, what have I done with my life? And what impression have I left on my friends? And have I told my family everything I want to tell them? Like, do people know how much I love them? Do people know how much they mean to me? What have I left in this tiny blink of an eye that is a lifetime? Like, what is the thing that I've left in this planet? How will my future generations of family remember me as their great grandfather or their grandfather? Or, you know, and I hadn't had kids, so I was going, will I ever get that? Will I ever get that experience of having children? And if I do, I mean, this is really weird, because before I went to South America, I was in a really wonderful, happy relationship with a wonderful, happy person. She was amazing. We were moving towards getting married and having children, but there was something that was in the back of my mind, which is like, if we just keep moving and we get married and have kids, what possible wisdom could I impart on those kids? I don't even know who I am. I don't know who I am as a person. I don't know what wisdom to pass to a child. I can't accept that responsibility of being a father. And I kind of ran from this relationship, and this whole trip to South America was part of me, like, you know, running away and like, who am I? What do I want from my life? But then I came to realize, holy shit, I actually do have something I can teach my kids, which is don't follow a life of stuff you don't feel passionate about. Don't waste your 8 hours a day doing something you hate. Don't spend all that time pursuing material success or career success. Use, like, get whatever you can out of life. Like, just get what you can out of it. Because when you're dying, you're not going to remember the career stuff. You're going to think about the lessons you learned or the people you met or the wonderful friendships you've made or the family. And I'd like always wanted kids, but I just never thought I was ready for it. And then in this time in hospital, there were a few nights where I just cried and cried and cried at the thought that I would not be able to have children, and at the thought that I would never, now that I was finally ready and I knew what I wanted to teach them, I would never get that opportunity.
Christian, you said there were 10 doctors working on your case around Australia. Were you an exotic specimen?
Yeah, I actually started to sense excitement from doctors when they came to see me. And I would hear them talk about other cases down the hall in a really dull way, like, oh, I've got to go get back to that thing. Like, this is the exciting case. Doctors became really enthusiastic about the drugs and the treatment and the combination. And it was around this time, a couple of months in, like, you said to me, what did that hospital room represent to you? And how did you feel when you were in there? And yeah, across a couple of those months, this hospital room felt like a jail cell, and it felt like I was being confined, and I felt emotionally destroyed. But it was around this time when I was realizing, like, I have 10 doctors working on this case. I am in the safest possible place I could be. I have a whole hospital room to myself. I am fortunate. And I feel like a dickhead that it took me that long to actually realize how lucky I was. There are millions of people all over the world with very similar, if not the same, disease who can't even see a doctor, and I've got 10 of them Skyping daily to talk about me. I'm in this room by myself where I'm not going to be exposed to another bug that could come in and make this whole situation worse. I'm not going to infect my family members and the people I love. Like, it's incredible that I'm receiving this level of treatment. The other little ironic thing about all this is my father's South African. He moved from South Africa to Australia so that he could raise his family in a fortunate way, somewhere safe. And he made a lot of sacrifices for that. He left all his friends behind. He came to Australia at a time when all South Africans were considered racist. He loved that country. He loved that land. He loved the sun in the sky. He would often cry when he saw South Africa on television. And he moved here so that I would be fortunate enough to receive that kind of healthcare that I was getting 28 years later. And it was bizarre that Dad had moved from South Africa here to have this safe family. I'd gone to South Africa in 2005 to change my career and to better understand my father as a person, only to have contracted TB, come home, had it come out, and then been able to receive the care that I received as a result of Dad having moved there in the first place. It's crazy.
You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler.
So, Christian, if the kind of TB you had was multi-drug resistant, what kind of drug therapies could they use on you?
The thing about this multi-drug resistancy, all the drugs they use to treat standard TB have all been developed really recently. They're all the best top drugs that work great, that have minimal side effects, that are really effective. When you have multi-drug resistant any illness, those best drugs, they're out of contention. You cannot use them. So the doctors have to go back in time to look at drugs from the 80s, 70s, 60s, things that are off market, things that the bugs wouldn't have been exposed to, things that are off market for a reason. They've been replaced. There are better drugs out there. Their side effects are brutal. They're really strong and they're hard on the body. You know, they have a slightly lesser effect on the organisms themselves, so they're not going to be as good and they're going to be harder on you. So I was on a combination of drugs from the 60s and 70s that were really expensive. They were from the bottom of the barrel, the last of the batches. They were sourced from all over the world. And all of a sudden, the one doctor who was dealing with me at my hospital was now sharing that load with a panel of 10 doctors from around the country who had some degree of experience working in this area.
Who could come and see you at that time? Friends, family?
So any doctor or nurse who came into the room had to wear gloves, mask, plastic apron, and that was the same case for anybody who wanted to come in and visit. I would get visitation from friends and family and all sorts of things, but I didn't see a full human face for months because I only saw people's eyes. And we probably take for granted how much we pick up in terms of communication from the full picture of the human face that we're dealing with. But for so long, I was just dealing with eyeballs and masks. And I started to sketch out a little bit. I wouldn't know if someone was smiling under there or if they were frowning or if they were kind of angry at me or being kind. The signals started to kind of blur a little bit there. I was also on like these really heavy medications. One of them, among the listed side effects, are like mega depression, paranoia, and suicidal tendencies. And I started to develop this insane web of paranoia while I was in hospital. I guess not getting daylight and not leaving the room also does that. Like, isolation itself is also a bit hard on the old brain. But this drug in particular, I had cooked up this crazy conspiracy in my head that everybody wanted me to die of this disease because it would be better for the overall greater good of humanity if some 27-year-old Western male was to die of multi-drug-resistant tuberculosis. Then all of a sudden, it'll be high profile and it would be a big thing in the news, and then everybody would start realizing that tuberculosis needs funding too. I'd been talking to the World Health Organization, who were telling me that, like, oh, you know, tuberculosis, it's not really a sexy disease. It's something that only affects poor people and, you know, impoverished areas. And It's a bit like HIV before famous people and high-profile people started dying of it. It just gets no attention. So it won't be until that happens that, you know, we'll be able to start getting some proper funding for the treatment of TB. And so anyway, I'd heard all that and I was like, oh, this is what's happening. Everyone's going to let me die so that the funding of TB increases. And it took me a little while to break out of that paranoid web. Nurses were involved in that. My doctors were involved in that. My family was involved in that. And it was just this thing that I snapped in and out of, depending on whether I was in the cloud of the drugs or whether I had a clear head.
How about your brother? What role did he have at this time with you?
My brother, I thank the lucky stars every single day that I have my brother in my life. We're 2 years apart, so we were super tight growing up. He's my little brother. We were like clinging to each other's arms. We just played dress up all day, every day, sword fighting, hanging out. We were each other's best friends for so long in life. And then at some point during our teenage years, I started trying to get popular and trying to be cool. And, you know, I started brushing him off and I wasn't good to him and I didn't treat him well. You know, I was just becoming a dickhead older brother. And then, I don't know, you start fighting about bedrooms and, oh, you're wearing my shirt and I want the bigger steak and all those things that you just fight about as siblings. And this great chasm had grown between us where we just weren't friends anymore and we hardly spoke to each other and we weren't really involved in each other's lives. And then all this happened and he was there by my side at every opportunity he could be. I get a bit emotional about it because all the difference between us, none of that mattered when I got sick. And he was just there for me. And he'd come in, you know, he'd spend hours and hours in there. And the doctors would say, oh, you should probably go now. And he'd be like, nah, I think I'll just hang out a bit longer. And he's probably putting himself at risk. But he taught me how to make videos and he helped me make videos. And we started shooting stuff together and helped accumulate gear for me in there. And we wrote stuff together and he wrote stuff for me. And I couldn't have done it all without him. We got really close throughout that period. And then, you know, as soon as we got out, we just went, oh, this is what, should we do this? Should we just work together? Should we try and make a life out of this? And we've since been working together and we write together and we're business partners and best friends. I'm really, really lucky to have him. And this is the guy that he is. Like, he's the guy who's there for you. Our dad got cancer about a year and a half ago. And again, Connor was just there by dad's side every time he could be and just sit with him and guide him through it all. And towards the end, when dad was passing away, he was there for him in the same way that he was there for me. Yeah, he's a really good man.
With all this going on, was there a change in the way you saw yourself in hospital, Christian?
Yeah, I suppose when I first got to hospital, I'd walk down this corridor where all the quarantine rooms were, and they kind of had all these airlock doors on the left and right side of the corridor, and I'd look through a couple of windows, and I'd kind of, you know, in one room, this kind of like really old dude shouting and stomping about with crazy wild hair, and in another room, like angry Asian guy shouting at a nurse, and in another room, just a completely still person sitting there staring at the walls, looking really unhealthy. And I remember thinking at the time, I think I'm all right. I don't think I'm like these people. They're all crazy patients and I'm fine. And then at some point during my isolation, I stared at myself in the mirror and I was like, you are them. You are a crazy patient. Look at you. Like this, my hair had got long, I had a big long beard, standing there in a hospital gown, which had been the only thing I'd worn in weeks. And strangely, that was a really freeing, it was a freeing self-analysis. Like as soon as I went, hold on a second, you're a patient. You live in a hospital. You have one job and that's get better. Like you have one thing to focus on. You don't have to worry about all the other shit you're worrying about. Forget about your apartment and your rent and your car and your job and let them all go. Let all that stuff go. Girlfriends, all that. Don't worry about any of that. Just get better. And at that point, I guess I kind of just focused on trying to give my life some structure. And I went, okay, you live in a hospital. What do we do? Let's stop thinking about the finish line because that keeps moving. Let's stop thinking about when we're getting out of here. Let's make this time as good as we can. Okay, what can we do for exercise? They bought me in an exercise bike. All right, Mum, Connor, I need to train. They bought me in some weights and a yoga mat. And I started turning the hospital room into a studio so I could make YouTube videos and write music. And I fully just scheduled out all my days. I went, okay, cool. We're going to do 9 to 5 in here. At 9 a.m., we're going to start our day by doing an hour of exercise on the exercise bike and at the same time watch an episode of a TV show. Then when it hits 10, we're going to jump on the laptop, we're going to do some emails, blah, blah, blah. 11 a.m., cool, we're going to start writing some music, let's do that. That will take us from 11 to 12:30. Okay, now it's lunchtime, lunch. Relax for a little bit, then we're going to meditate in the afternoon, then we're going to do some push-ups, then we're going to... Like, I literally just had this kind of like 9 to 5 structured day and it helped me so much because every single day just became... Let's just get through this day. Let's do that day. Let's complete that schedule. Previously, time had been blurring. It didn't seem to matter whether I was awake or asleep during day or night. Like, it's all the same.
Were you ever able to get out of that space while you were under treatment?
So the medications they were giving me, one of them had side effects that could cause damage to sight, and one of them could cause side effects that could cause damage to hearing. So after a while, they started sending me for regular sight and hearing tests. And sometimes I had to go off-site to another hospital to do that. And so they'd put me in a mask and gloves and stick me in the back of a car over to another hospital. And that was always lovely. And it was always nice to just get out of the room. And then towards the end of the stay, once we knew that they'd kind of cracked the right medications, I'd asked if I could get some free time to go out and sit in the domain. And I'd asked if I could just go out there for an hour a day. And so they, you know, doctors had a chat about it and then they allowed it. And so from that point, I was kind of allowed to go out and spend an hour a day sitting in the domain.
There's grass. God, that must have felt sweet.
It was the best thing ever. I could feel the sun on my skin like it was a sheet, you know, like a hot sheet that was just laying across my skin. And I would just take my shirt off, sit there in my shorts, lie on the grass, listen to my favorite songs with my headphones on, smiling, sitting there in the grass. You know, I got a footy so I could just kick a footy around to myself in the park. Really made me think of like what that must mean. If you're in jail or something, like what it must mean for that hour you get to walk around. Or if you're someone who like lives in darkness who just kind of gets that light for short periods of time. I don't know. It was like incredible. Nothing's ever felt that good than just an hour of sunlight in the domain felt during that period.
How did you put your first video together? I mean, I've seen it. It's amazing. How did you do that inside that room at the time, Christian? Because this is, what, 2010, isn't it? So the software isn't where it is now, and the social media was barely not even there, really. Well, how did you do all that?
Yeah, I mean, it was 2009 when I went in there, and I was the guy from my friend group who was, like, super anti-social media. I didn't have a Facebook page set up. I was very much... a physical social person. Like, I thought that the best thing you could do is just hang out with your friends physically. That changed a lot when I got thrown into a hospital room. I was realizing when people were coming to visit, they weren't kind of sure of how serious or not serious to be about it all. And I could sense that it was kind of a hard thing to come and visit a friend who's like really ill, and people don't know how to deal with it. They don't know how you're supposed to speak to someone. And at the same time, also, I was incredibly bored in hospital. I wanted to be productive with my time. And I just bought a MacBook, and I had no idea how to use it. And I fired it up and had this program called GarageBand where you could kind of make music. And I thought, oh, you know, that's a decent way to spend some time. I'll just learn how to make a beat or make some music in this program. And so I did that. And then I thought, oh, okay, it's got a mic in my laptop. All right, I'll record some lyrics to it. I quite like the beat. Obviously, everything that was on my mind at the time was just about being sick, about being ill. So I ended up writing this rap song about being sick. And some friends came to visit and they said, oh, what have you been doing in here? And I was like, oh, I did do this. And I played them the song. And they all cracked up and it suddenly just opened a thing of like, oh, okay, so this is sweet. We can joke about it now. And I really enjoyed that. And one of my friends had gone, why don't you make a video for it? And I was like, well, I don't know how to do that. And he goes, you've got a camera built into your laptop. Just film it on that. And there's another program called iMovie where you can edit it all together. Like, that'll be funny. And so I thought, why not? And so I made a video for it and I cut it together. And I was like so not techie at the time that I just couldn't understand why I couldn't email the video to my friends. But it was a 136 megabyte file, so of course it wouldn't send via email. And so I called up my friend and said, oh, you know, I made a video, but I'm not going to be able to send it to you because it doesn't fit in an email. And he's like, oh man, there's a website called YouTube. And if you just upload the video to YouTube, then all you have to do is send me a link and you can do that via email. So I uploaded the video to YouTube and I emailed my friend the link, and then he immediately shared it on his Facebook page. And I didn't have a Facebook, so I didn't know that he'd shared it. The next day I woke up and I'd had a couple of calls from him, and he's like, man, there's a lot of people sharing this video off my Facebook page. And so I clicked on the video and had a look, and it had like 10,000 views now. And that was weird because I just sent it to him yesterday and now 10,000 people have watched it. Next thing I know, I'd received, someone else got in contact with me saying, oh, there's this guy, Ben Fordham from the radio. And so I ended up talking to Ben Fordham, and Ben Fordham's like, mate, I love it so much. It's great. I'm friends with the guys who are on the Today Show. And so they put me on the Today Show via Skype, and I was just being a dickhead, having fun with it because I wasn't taking the whole thing very seriously. But they, on the Today Show, the little super that they put beneath a photo of my head said the fully sick rapper. And some girl had found that obviously really funny and had set up a Facebook page that was called I Love the Fully Sick Rapper. And people started clicking like on it, and the video was getting passed around more and more. And then she contacted me and said, hey, I just set up this page as a bit of a joke, but now all these people are starting to like it. Do you want to take over the page? Like, do you want to run it? So I signed up to Facebook, set up a Facebook page for myself personally, and then I changed it from I love the Fully Sick Rapper to just the Fully Sick Rapper. And it just started to gather likes, and I started to use that as a way to talk to people and a way to share my days in hospital. And then I just started making more and more music, all sickness or germophobic or TB related rap songs that I just started to post to a YouTube channel.
How did that change your life?
On lots of different levels, this changed my life significantly. My brother had been through film school. He'd made his first couple of short films, but he was really struggling to find an avenue where people could watch those films. Even if you're lucky enough to make it into a film festival, the odds that more than 200 people will see that film is pretty slim again. And here I was making videos in the hospital room that were reaching hundreds of thousands of people. And so he was like, why don't we, make some stuff together? Like, why don't we work together? Because I kind of know what I'm doing on the film side, and you've got this audience that's developing, so let's kind of make stuff together. And so that's what we started doing. And so making these YouTube videos and putting them out into the world opened up my hospital room in a massive way. Like, all of a sudden I had loads of people from around the world who I was in contact with. From being solo, stuck in a hospital room, I was now connected to the world. I started talking to other people with tuberculosis who had similar situations that they were going through. I joined this kind of like TB alliance of people who are trying to raise awareness and raise more money for TB. I got contacted by the World Health Organization to help make some content for World TB Day, and that then opened up my ability to talk directly to Geneva and ask questions and learn more about my own illness. I spoke to other people who had been isolated in all sorts of different ways, some of them from illness, others just by, wanting to extract themselves from society. I ended up having a couple of amazing things happen. One of them was that, a webcam girl contacted me. She'd seen my video and said, look, I kind of dance, nude on the internet for a job. I'd love to give you some free dances if you like.
Wow.
Yeah. So it became a kind of bi-weekly thing where I would hang a little notice over the window saying, busy working, please do not disturb. And then I'd go on these like little web dates. And we took some of them. I mean, she was amazing. Like, we took some of them quite far. One of them, she put on this dress and pretended to be in a bar in New York, and I got my brother to bring me in a suit jacket and a nice shirt, and I dressed up like I was, high-flying New York dude in town, and we just role-played the whole way through a kind of date in a bar where she was drinking whiskey in the United States and I was drinking water pretending it was vodka on the rocks. Romantically, it opened my life up in that kind of weird way. And then also these students who loved the video, these guys who had just finished high school, they took me to their prom. Like, they were like, oh, dude, feel sorry for you, stuck there. You're coming to prom with us. And so they printed a bunch of like face masks of my head, and this whole group of friends, like 8 or 10 of them, went to prom and they took photos the whole way through prom night with my head on there, and they sent me this group of like 50 photos of like this wild night that I'd been on where girls were kissing my face and where I was partying on the dance floor and catching buses all over town and going to nightclubs. And like, it was crazy the things that were coming out of this and the ability for it to just open up my world. Like, I now accepted that this is my life and I'm sick and I live in a hospital room, but these types of things would never have happened to me outside hospital. It was incredible the way that making stuff from inside that room connected me with the world in such a crazy way.
So what was it that finally allowed you to leave that room, Christian?
From when I first got back in there with multidrug-resistant tuberculosis, they basically said, here's the deal. We need to come up with a set of medications that work against it. We need to make sure those medications are working, and then we need to have 10 weeks of clear samples from you. So every single day, I'm coughing into sputum jars. They're sending them away to the lab, splitting it into petri dishes, growing it, exposing it to drugs, seeing how much bacteria is there. This is a constant cycle where every day they're adding new tests and taking old tests out and checking them. And so I needed 10 weeks of consecutively clean tests with not a single bug in any of them. And so sometimes I'd get to 5 weeks of clean tests and then there'd be bugs in one. Other times, 2 weeks, then bugs in one. One time I think I got to like 8 weeks and I was thinking, I'm only getting 2 more weeks of clean tests and I'm gone. And then we got other tests came back. So that was quite tragic every time that happened. Like I said, I got myself to the mental point where I was just like, I'm not thinking about a finish line anymore. As far as I'm concerned, this is where I live and this is what I do and this is now my life. So I'm going to stop thinking about when I get out of here. So I told the doctors, don't tell me anymore how many clean tests I have. I just want to keep my head down, do my time, and then you come in one day and you tell me when I can go. And that's exactly what happened. It got to a point where the medications had been working. I'd long stopped coughing blood. I was feeling a lot better physically. I was starting to look better physically. I was getting that hour of sun every day. I was starting to feel healthy again. And then just one day the doctors came in, said, look, you've had 10 weeks of clean tests. We're going to send you home on Monday. And so it was as simple as that. And it had been 6 months of being inside. And that was a point where I knew I had 1 weekend left and then I was going to get to go home. And on Monday, I packed my stuff up and family came in and helped and walked out. So it was all very just simple and normal and not grandiose. And, not, it was all right, going home. Awesome.
So how weird was it being back in the normal world again after all that time?
The weird thing then about getting home is I'd reached a point where it was really simple for me mentally in hospital. I just knew what I had to do and how I had to be there. But coming home was a whole new challenge because I was kind of free and I was kind of returning to life as normal. But it also wasn't normal because I still had to go to a hospital once a day for about 3 hours to have medications given to me. And I was still on all those medications. And for another 12 months, I was going to hospital every day for 2 or 3 hours to have my, intravenous drugs run through. I was still wearing a PICC line, which is a little line that goes in through your arm and runs to your heart so they can easily give you medications and take blood and all that stuff. I was still blurry for 2 or 3 hours a day from taking all the medications that they gave me. And I kind of felt a bit 1 foot in, 1 foot out. I mean, to be honest, it was almost easier just being in the hospital room because it was simpler for me to compartmentalize my life and just go, here's where I am. But then when I was out of hospital, I had no money, had no kind of job or any of that stuff. So I moved back in with my parents and I was living with my parents and me and my brother were making stuff. That was great. But yeah, I was still going through all the side effects and was still kind of paranoid and a bit bugging out and taking a lot of medication. And yeah, it was strangely a bit harder that 12 months than the other 6 months was.
So Christian, it sounds to me like the key for getting through that long period of captivity for you was creativity and routine.
It's absolutely routine, schedule, and the management of your own expectations. I think human beings are amazingly resilient. We just need to accept that this is the way things are now. And when you do that, life gets a lot easier no matter what you're going through. But yeah, I do think a lot of us will come out of this there'll be some positive changes for people who actually just realise how great normality is when they get it back.
Really great to speak with you, Christian. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Really appreciate it.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Hi, I'm Nazim Hussain. I'm a comedian, so naturally, I'm really good with money. I'm also the new host of The Pineapple Project, a new series of the podcast all about making life sweeter. This season, we're on a mission to make you rich. Well, richer. We're not going to tell you how to play the share market or start a multi-level marketing scheme selling you, I don't know, Nazim Hussain action figurines. Although if you do want one, there's only 499 left, so get in quick. I bought the first one. This is a podcast about saying no to all the stuff the world convinces us we need to buy to be happy, and helping you save a ton on things like phones, cars, eating out, and clothes. So join me for Frugal by The Pineapple Project. Get richer now and get it on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.